Well, we're giving you a lot of solutions here, and you're going to come back with this homework assignment. Tell us a couple of weeks from now what you did. You got a KQLAW.
So there's another thing to get back to me soon.
Roger. Kate first, go ahead.
I was also thinking to solve all this rigmarole of making, you know, virus hookups and capacitors, things like that. What also could be done is to install a DC jack in the unit, you know, drill a hole in the back and jump the battery terminals inside and then just put a DC jack into it. And it also has to charge a built-in 7.2 volt battery, a 2000 milliamp hour NIMH battery. So I can rig it so that I can plug in a DC adapter into the wall. Yeah, I got to bring the DC adapter along me to charge it, but I think that's the easier way of, you know, getting into the unit, because the unit does not have a DC input. So that's actually a great idea. Let's say you want to bring it in the car or something like that. You can plug it into a cigarette lighter plug. So that's another way to do it. Keep it to the mirror back to that.
Another very good way. And that way you can feed directly the proper DC voltage into the real working circuit of the tape recorder. However, when it's running on its transformer, if I sense correctly what you're saying, it is capable of not only running the tape recorder, but charging its internal rechargeable battery. Let's assume that the tape recorder runs on 7.5 volts, and this is a 7.5 volt NiCad battery pack in there. And when it's running on its transformer, that rectifier network gives it 9 volts. The 9 volts becomes regulated. The regulated voltage runs the charging of the battery as well as running the tape recorder. So if you find that part of the circuit and you tap into it with your external jack, you can now feed it 9 volts. That's my example. And therefore, you have the capability of doing both charging and running the tape recorder. So I think you've got a number of options here, Gabe. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead with your suggestion for Gabe, K2RIW.
Yeah, exactly what I was going to say. Whatever the secondary of the supply is, forget about that transformer. Just take it out, throw it out, put a jack in, that's it, and use a wall wart that will give you the necessary DC voltage and be done with it. It'll charge the battery, it'll run the tape recorder, and again, also, if runs off 12 volts, because it's a 12-volt system, it'd be great. Then you can take it in the mobile, in a car, and, you know, plug it into the cigarette lighter. That's basically what I was thinking. Forget about fussing with the transformer and everything like that. Go to a simple device, put the jack in, like you would say, in a DC jack, and be done with it, Dick, over.
Very fine. Alrighty. Looks like we've come to a bunch of conclusions here for your tape recorder, Gabe. And portable small tape recorders, they're fun. And the purely solid-state ones, they've got their advantages, but I'm not in love with them yet. I like the old-fashioned tape recorder where I can easily zip to the spot I want, unplug one tape, plug in another tape, flip it over, and whatever. It has certain conveniences. By the same token, there are people who just love reading the newspaper and reading technical articles and getting their proceedings on their computer, as opposed to getting hard copy tape.
2 meter, transmit.
What I find out is that when I'm flipping through a paper magazine, hard copy, I can easily get from the beginning of one article to the end of the next one and whatever. Flipping paper to me is a lot faster, and I get a lot higher resolution. To move things on a computer screen, to properly manipulate them, if you go through the booting problem and the downloading time and the storage problems and finding it, storing it, and properly naming it and whatever, to me that's more trouble than it's worth.
Hey, Dave?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you obviously have never used a commercial audio device, which is actually made by Sony and a few others and stuff like that. A little handheld device that actually has more accuracy than a tape recorder. You can find any particular spot of music easier than you can because it's random access, and you don't have to go through the spool of tape to find this spot. And you can actually pretend that you're rocking the reels looking for an exact phrase or a space, And they're not really expensive, but it's not your area of expertise, so to speak. But there's stuff out there that would amaze us.
WB2HWW, please.
Okay. You got a nice, loud carrier and tremendous audio. You're going to have to back off on the audio a little bit, Howie. But let me finish with Eric first. Eric, you're absolutely right. If I was a real 21st century person, as opposed to a 20th century person, I should learn the new technology of solid-state devices for recording audio and or video. I've got to come up to the 21st century. Go ahead with your comment, Howie, KQLIW.
Okay, Dick. What you really should do is this. You should use a UPS, an uninterruptible power source, that would give you like from 220 to 110, give you 220, just like they have a UPS in the United States that will... to 220 at 50 hertz. Do you understand where I'm going with that, Dick?
I sure do, Howie. Your audio is also a little bit heavy. You gotta back off a little bit further. That's not a bad idea. So there are UPSs that will do the voltage conversion for you and or the frequency conversion. However, most UPSs that I've seen, Howie, are fairly bulky devices. And what Gabe was complaining about is that he, even if he carries around a step-up transformer, to him it's too bulky. He's willing to carry around something the size of a wall wart, but a UPS and its internal battery, we're talking about a lot more massive hardware. You've got a good electronic solution, but mechanically I think Gabe's going to be a little bit unhappy with that. He's looking for small size, lightweight portability with his particular network. Thank you for bringing that suggestion to our attention. So Gabe, I'm going to turn it back to you for any final, any fills that you need. And as I said, we're giving you a significant homework assignment. Please come back and tell me. Please come back and tell us how it all worked out and what your final... tell us what your final solution was. You got it. KB2MAR, K2LAW. Wait for the beep.
K2RW, KB2MAR. TC Jack. This is the catch, though. You're still under warranty. So if something goes wrong, when I made this modification to it, then I can't give it back for service or anything like that. So I think I'm going to have to be stuck with getting the portable, that 220-110 transformer to begin with for the time being. Then I can always use that transformer to power other things. Let's say that I have something from Europe sent over here, but I can always keep it as something to use it in the future, something like that. But through the modifications to the unit, I'm asking for trouble. So you never know, something could happen. It's under warranty and all that, so that's the thing. But another way to do it too is also thinking that particular unit used to come in a U.S. version, but they discontinued it. They stopped making it. The European version is available. But what I could do is order the transformer from the American version and just install it into the European version, because it's the same exact unit, except it's the power supply is different. But then again, see, that's the warranty situation. KB2MAR, back to that.
Okay, do you, Jack? Yeah, I've got a solution on that, but let's see what Eric's got to say. Go ahead, Eric. What's the output voltage that he needs?
He needs 230. It runs, it's designed for 230 at 50 hertz, and he'd like to run it in the United States. Over to you.
Yeah, but does it make DC and the unit runs on DC, or has it got 220 going into it?
We're reasonably sure it takes the 230 volts into the primary of the transformer, secondary rectifies it, makes DC, and that runs the battery charger as well as the tape recorder. Over to you, Eric.
All right, because I was going to suggest they do make wall warts that are switching supplies. You can get them out of DigiKey. They run anywhere from 100 to 280, actually. But if he's got a transformer in there, well, I can say that, how much current does he need? He doesn't need too much current. I've got a really small international transformer that lets you go from 100 volts, like in Japan, all the way up to 280, and it'll give you outputs at any voltage that you want. And it's light, but we're talking low current here.
Comment.
Yeah, his whole tape recorder, comment recognized. His whole tape recorder, I'd like to believe, is only running a few watts of a primary power requirement. That universal transformer of yours, how expensive is it, and where we can go to buy it, Eric? Over to you, Eric. Wait for the beep.
All right. Well, you can get them in Manhattan at a couple of the places which sell international VCRs and stuff like that. The one that I have, I actually picked up in Akihabara in Tokyo in Japan. But also, in the you can go to L&L. He's got a couple of them. Because we've taken a lot of stuff to Europe that we've had to use, and we bought some stuff that we had to use back here, so it goes either way. Actually, it's just a matter of which end of the transformer you plug in. Also, if you go to Home Depot, they have these little travel transformers that go both ways, too. So, and they only weigh like, they're less than a pound. They're tiny. But I think they're only good for like about 75 watts or something like that.
No way to get them in New York to say a stick.
Only need 14 watts. 1-4 watts.
You've got it made. He's good for 75 watts. Well, we've got Wesley and Mel in that order. Wesley and 2XJN, go ahead with your comment.
Comment.
Okay, I have a comment very, a little bit unusual. There is a place being called Wizard, and it's in Manhattan Avenue in Greenport. Guys are Polish guys, and they are selling a lot of equipment, and they have converters, transformers from 110 to 220. Now, imagine one thing. You take 220 between phases in here, and you just plug this reverse way. Now, I understand that you're going to come up with what is the power that you can cover only if you just exchange the primary to the secondary and whatever. That's one of the solutions. Now, the second solution from the general theory in the practice that you didn't mention is you have a transformer, different stack of the transformers, but let's say you have two transformers alike. Now, if you could say something about connecting these transformers in series and parallel and to XJ.
Another very good suggestion. I like that. And I didn't think about that one. Let me reword what I think Wesley just said. Assume now you've got a pair of transformers that are identical, and they've got they're a pair of very small isolation transformers. They're designed for 120 in, 120 out isolation transformers. Small, but identical, and a pair of them. And now you hook them up in such a way that the two primaries running at 115 volts are in parallel, the two secondaries running at 115 volts are in series, phased the right way. Now you're making 230. So that's another approach. In other words, the windings we're talking about, the four-wire primary winding, it doesn't all have to be on the same piece of iron. If you're smart enough, they can be two completely separate transformers that are identical, or nearly identical. And in fact, they don't even have to be nearly identical, just as long as they're both 115 in and something like 115 or 230 output. Well, they had 230 output. One transformer would do it. So a pair of isolation transformers, 115 in, 150 out, will do it very nicely. Okay, the next person who's got a comment was Mel, K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, I remember now. This is K2KEY. I needed one of these little transformer gadgets so I could run my electric razor in Europe. And I remember where I got it now in New York many years ago. It's a place, B&H, on I think it's 10th Avenue, 11th Avenue, and about 30-something Street. B&H is the name of the place, Dick. They got all that kind of stuff. And, yeah, making an isolation, I used to do that years back, my poor man's isolation, using, you know, two filaments, cheap old filament transformers. I used to get a lot of them, 110 to 6.3, and you put them in, use, make yourself an isolation setup, so you can make any of those arrangements. But they had a nice little transformer that they sold that was for universal use all over the goddamn Europe and into Japan or wherever you were going to go, and it sold at B&H, a very cheap device. I think I paid about $11 over.
33rd, between 34th and 33rd on 9th Avenue. Sounds like these two still exist. So to reword what Mel just told us, he's got lots of 6.3 volt or 12.6 volt filament transformers around the house, and he needed an isolation transformer. A pair of 6.3 volt filament transformers wired back to back, 115 volts into one, 6.3 volts out of that one. Put the 6.3 volts out of the first into the 6.3 volt winding of the second. Now the 110 volt winding of the second is giving you 110 volts. And that whole setup of two transformers with the filament voltage in between is a kind of a poor man's isolation transformer. And for reasonably small wattage, it does a pretty good job. You may also be tempted to take a 12.6 volt filament transformer wired into the 6.3 volt winding of a second transformer to do voltage doubling. You can't do that. You try to get more than twice the voltage out of a winding that's made for 110, and you want to get 220 out of it. You're asking for twice as much saturation of the iron compared to the way it was originally designed. Unless that original design was super conservative, but there was a lot of extra iron in there, you'll saturate. That won't work. You could do voltage doubling up to the point where you get 110 volts out of the 110 volt winding. Don't expect 230 volts out of 110 volt winding. You can't do that. Okay. There was another person who said comment. I wonder who that was. Please identify yourself right now. Call it as a name. K2RIW.
And to exchange with this comment, I'm sorry interrupting you. You didn't mention the thickness of the wire and how it behaves when you do that.
In a way I did. Where Gabe was talking about rewinding the wire that's there by simply taking off half the turns, I did give him warning that that may not work, because when he takes off half the turns, that 230 volt primary now is happy with 115. That's the good news. But now the remaining wire at 115 will be conducting twice the current. Unless he increases the gauge of that wire, it may not make it. Again, unless that transformer was very conservative in its design. Well, the way Europeans like to make things efficient, compact, inexpensive, lightweight, and so on, to have that much extra iron and conservativeness and extra winding a wire gauge is not likely. So what Wesley is telling us, and he's absolutely right, it's not too difficult to calculate the current that's going to flow through any of these windings we're talking about. Go to the wire table in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, among many other places, and make sure that the current you're putting through that wire is appropriate for that gauge of wire you're using for that application. And by that I mean, there's one amount of current you can put through a wire when the wire is laying out in the fresh air and it can be cooled. There's another current at a lower number you can put when the wire is inside of a conduit. There's an even lower number of current you can put through that gauge of wire when it's the winding of a transformer. It's hidden inside of all of those laminations and the potting material and the outer case. And it's got all this stuff that won't allow it to cool itself. So you got to make sure you look at the current rating for that gauge of wire for that particular application. There's a lot of art and science that goes into a transformer. There's one more thing I want to tell you about, Gabe, that you've got a solution to that doesn't violate your warranty. Let me drop. And that is, the elegant solution is to put in a jack which allows you to put in external DC voltage from a wall wart or whatever. And now you're going to be drilling holes in the case and surely violating the warranty. However, if you're careful in the way you open up the case of that unit, you will not leave any marks that allow them to know that you've climbed inside and violated the warranty. Once you're inside, you install a piece of cable.
that you snake out of the side of the case somewhere. There may be a hole, or maybe even the case you leave open a little bit. There's a way you can snake out a pair of wires and then install a jack that's a pendant cable jack, you know, floating on the end of the cable outside of your unit. And now you can plug in the DC voltage from the outside world and not be violating the warranty. If you need to go to the warranty, you then open up the case, unsolder your external piece of wire, and put everything back the way it was. And there's one more solution, and that is for a guy of your wherewithal, Gabe, for a guy with your smarts, you don't really have to worry about the warranty. With the friends you've got on this particular repeater, with people like Andy, the V3CDL, that can fix anything that's made out of tubes or transistors, as such, you don't need a warranty. You can always get a fix. With one slight exception, there may be an exotic part in there that's hard to get in order to replace it. You hope that part doesn't fail. But other than that, I've never worried about warranties. As long as I'm careful when I open up cases to modify and fix anything that I own, I don't worry about warranties. Okay, I think we're going to move on, Kate. And as I said, come back and let us know how it all turns out. The next person we've been keeping waiting was Joe, the B2RYY. He had a question or a comment. You got it, Joe? K2RIW, wait for the beep.
Okay, I had a question on something of a subject completely unrelated to what you're talking about currently, but it's right up your alley anyway. As to a radar, what is an echo box, and how does it work?
It works quite well. I got to be brief. I'm much too verbose. It works pretty well. You turn the dial until it's tuned to the frequency of the radio you're operating at. You connect it to the antenna port of the radar. You connect it to a sampling port of the antenna port of the radar. And it gives you a blip on the screen. Anything else you want to know, Joe? That was a joke.
That's about as brief as I guess you'd be, correct?
Are you telling me you're demanding the full story? You don't just want the brief story, Joe? Go ahead.
That is correct.
You heard it, fellas. He's demanding the whole verbose, free, full story. I forced him into it at gunpoint. Okay, I'm having some fun with the joke because I know you're a pretty tough guy and you can take it. An echo box for radar consists of an extremely high Q cavity, probably running at around Q of 5,000. When you know the Q of an electronic resonator, something that has an LC equivalent, or it's usually a reentrant cavity resonator, once you tune it to the right frequency, and a frequency meter, by the way, the old-fashioned mechanical frequency meters come close. What happens is the radar transmits its pulse that's intended to go to the radar antenna and be transmitted out into space. And you arrange it so you have the right coupling coefficient so that that radar pulse is coupled into your cavity. Once you know the Q of the cavity and you know the frequency of that, you can calculate exactly how many cycles the cavity will go through when it rings down. So you put RF energy into a resonator, and you disconnect the RF energy, common sense would lead you to believe that the signal in that resonator goes away immediately. No way in hell. It's very similar to when you strike a bell or you hit a tuning fork. Both of those are a high-Q device, and you're going to hear sound coming out of it for some time. It's got stored energy, and the energy is slowly being dissipated. One of the four or five definitions of Q is how many cycles it will go through before it goes down to half voltage or 37% of voltage. 1 over E is the usual mathematical definition of ring down time. Call it rise time and fall time if you like. So the cavity has got a certain fall time. Therefore, during that fall time, the stored energy in that cavity is pouring the signal back into the waveguide when the radar has flipped from the transmit mode back to the receive mode. And therefore, you'll get a response on the screen that looks a little bit like the ground clutter you get. When you're using a real radar and the antenna is not tilted up high enough, the
the first few miles of display on the planned position indicator, the cathode ray tube oscilloscope, the first few miles will be showing you echo from your Earth, nearby Earth and trees and whatever that's around you. It's called ground clutter. And so you'll make a particular characteristic kind of ground clutter with that echo box when it's tuned to the right frequency. And the reason why they do this is because the known amount of energy you're coupling to the echo box, the known amount of time it's going to ring, allows you to put a known amount of signal for a period of time back into the radar. And if the radar is operating correctly and has the right sensitivity, you will see that signal on the screen for the proper period of time, which the radar displays as a proper number of miles apparent of signal on that screen. Wonder if that makes some sense, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the second half. Wait for the beep.
Time of trouble.
Yeah, that's what it really is. The radar sends out a pulse. It takes a certain amount of time to go out there, roughly 6 microseconds per nautical mile. It hits the target. The signal comes back from the target. It takes a certain amount of time to get back to the radar, 6 microseconds per nautical mile. So the total round trip time to a target and back is roughly 12 microseconds per mile. So if your echo box rang for 12 microseconds, it would give you approximately 1 mile of display on the radar screen of continuous signal that's slowly getting weaker. And if your radar screen in that example gave signals out to 1 mile apparent, then you know that the radar is working correctly. You haven't blown out its detector diode, and it's got normal sensitivity. So B2RYY, K2RYW, wait for the beep. I didn't.
Beautifully explained. I was working with radars.
Okay, there's a satisfied customer. We're going to have to send him a bill, Mel. He's complimenting us. He must like it. You got it, Joe.
Thank you for the explanation.
That's all? Okay. Alrighty, let's see. I think we've gone down the list of people. I think we ought to go over to Paul, find out what's going on in space. And I think I heard, Paul, that Spirit and Opportunity are having a little more difficulty. I think it's Opportunity that's stuck in the sand pile for the last 6 months or so. The good news is they've discovered that as they're trying to dig it out of the sand pile, that's the one that's dragging the wheel that's not working. It's got 6 wheels, and the front right wheel has jammed itself, doesn't turn. So the thing walked backwards, dragging that wheel. And now they're in this very soft, sandy material. They're down to the pan, so to speak, and it's stuck. And they're working on more and more elaborate techniques to get it unstuck. In the process, they dug through the surface of where they are, and they find this much lighter colored material under the darker colored surface, which again is giving them stronger and stronger indication that there was a hell of a lot of water on the surface of Mars in that area at one time. Follow the water, and it tells you where life potential was taking place. And all this communication back and forth between Spirit and Opportunity and the Deep Space Network of NASA has been taking place by way of the Mars orbital satellite, which I hear tell in the last couple of weeks that satellite failed. It was doing relay operation. And now the only way we can talk to Spirit and Opportunity is to talk directly without using that satellite as a relay. And that drastically slows down the rate at which you can communicate with it. Because now you're asking for that relatively weak signal coming out of Spirit and Opportunity that only had to go a few tens or hundreds of miles up to the satellite. Now has to go 300 million miles from the surface of Mars all the way back to the Goldstone receiving site, for instance. And with all that extreme extra range you're asking for the same number of watts of transmit out of Spirit and Opportunity, instead of getting, let me pick a number, 10 kilobits per second of data, you're now down to 3 kilobits per second of data. You got to go more narrow in the receiver, much more slow in the data rate, in order for that much weaker signal over the much greater number of miles to be above threshold, and you still get a good bit error rate. So now the rate at which they can talk to Spirit and Opportunity is cut down by orders of magnitude because of the failure of that satellite. I wonder if you heard any of those details, Paul. WS2N, our space expert. Wait for the beep. Try not to time out the machine, like I do, K2LIW. WS2N, are you there, Paul? Okay, maybe Paul got called away. Okay, go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, you just get into the subject that I have something to add to it. When I was working in Water Center 1, that was that scientific entity in SBR program that was working for NASA, and one of the subjects we were working on was extraterrestrial exploration of underground of planets and their moons. And our project was chosen, there was rapid resonance acoustical profiling that was able to read the data of underground of Mars to 2 miles. And one of that, that was one of the three projects that was chosen by NASA, but the reason that NASA didn't go with any one of the projects was actually because all of these projects required tremendous amount of data to be exchanged in the situation when there is no steady link and very weak signal. The interruption of the data supposed to be kept, and was one of the requirements at that time, kept within the certain intervals, so the data is being able to repeat themselves with less errors till it's fully received. And the second reason for the technology that wasn't really a price grant at that moment was that we were able to see absolutely everything, like we were able to see everything that is on the heat of the Earth structure, but we did not know what it is, unless there is a drilling to be done and the samples are being analyzed. And then let's say, for example, if there is a layer of gold at a certain depth, we could see exactly the layer, but we did not know what is in there. And they were looking for the technology that is not only able to show there is something there, but it is able to show what is the consistency, and they couldn't find it. So the bottom line is that the amount of data had to be short and has to be repeatable to the point that it's fully received with the, when all errors are eliminated. Back to you, Antoine.
And WS1 is back.
I got lots of comments on what Wesley just told us about. Fantastic project. He's describing a ground-penetrating radar. There's a relationship between it and a ultrasound machine that will do imaging inside of a human body. There's a slight similarity between the data processing, but tremendous amounts of data with high accuracy in either case has to be transmitted in order to do ground-penetrating radar. And where he's talking about taking a sample of gold and knowing what it would look like below that particular surface, I think they call that the signature verification. In other words, you have to recognize what gold, if that's what you're looking for, would look like on a ground-penetrating radar when that gold, the desired target, is buried inside of particular kinds of sand or soil or whatever. So it takes a number of confirmations of the local terrain in order to really know what you're looking at. But in order for the ground-penetrating radar to work correctly, you have to fly it multiple times over the same territory and get repeatability of that data. So we're talking about high accuracy in positioning of the satellite, high signal to noise ratio of the radio data you get out of it, tremendous number of megabytes of data comes out, which goes through a very elaborate Fourier transform in order to convert it into a three-dimensional picture, in order to really figure out what's going on with various reflectivities at various depths. You're into something called Stokes parameter mathematics and data reduction. And boy, there are people who have spent a lifetime digging into that mathematics, that radar technology, and so on. The word radar is one hell of a word. And you may think it's simple, and if you believe it, you don't understand the word. We're going to get back to it in a minute. Let's get a quick space report. time on the machine. And you may have heard what I said about the orbital satellite at Mars that failed. Therefore, we've got to talk directly to Spirit and Opportunity. Therefore, our data rate is drastically slowed. Our ability to dig it out of the sand is really going to be tough, isn't it, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, wait for the beep.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, they were supposed to get that up and running again, Dick. I don't know what happened with that one. It was some kind of conflict. I think it was another computer on board. They were going to switch between the two computers, and they were going to eliminate that risk. They were going to send a program up to it, but apparently that must have failed. Is that what you heard?
Now, the main thing that I heard that failed in the last couple of weeks was the orbital satellite that was acting as the repeater relay station. The actual transmitter, the X-band transmitter on Spirit and Opportunity, only has a couple of watts of output. It could transmit a fairly fast data rate into the orbital satellite going around Mars. Mars Orbital Observer, or whatever it's called, you know better than I do. And that would do store and record and forward. That would store the data on its solid-state memory. And then the satellite has got great big solar cells. It transmits a much higher power data and sends it all the way back to a gold star. Now that that satellite has failed, Spirit and Opportunity must transmit directly, not a couple of hundred miles up to a satellite, but 300 million miles to get from the surface of Mars back to Earth. Much more difficult path. Therefore, the data rate is drastically slowed down, and therefore, communicating back and forth and telling it what to do and uploading programs and whatever, everything has become, let me pick a number, 1,000 times more difficult in data rate and data accuracy and so on. So the failure of that satellite is one of the biggest impediments, but Spirit or Opportunity, whichever one is stuck, I'm going to guess it's Opportunity. It has dug through the surface. They see this lighter colored material underneath this darker colored crust. It dug through in the process of trying to get itself out of the stuck condition. As such, they're discovering some very different material down below. Everybody has suggested, why don't you use the arm to push yourself out? And I think they've already answered the question. The arm doesn't have anywhere near enough strength, and it has also had some failures. They also want to use the rat abrasion tool, the rock abrasion tool, to scatter the material to dig itself out, and it's had partial failures. So Spirit and Opportunity were designed for a 3-month service period, and here we are 4 years or so downrange. We're way beyond warranty. We love the data and the pictures we're getting from Spirit and Opportunity. There's two remote-controlled robots running around Mars, and we're continuing to use them, but they're way beyond warranty. So all these failures are most of them should have happened in the first 6 months. WS2N, wait for the beep. Don't time out the machine. K2LIW.
Okay, yes. Yeah, Spirit is the one that's stuck for a couple of months, I guess, now. And that's also the one with the bad wheel. They've been driving that thing backwards, dragging a wheel behind it. Yeah, okay. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is the one that they had problems with. They kept shutting itself down. It was going to a safe mode. And they were wondering what was causing it and this and that. And there was a backup computer on board. And they wanted to use that. But they had to send a signal up to tell it what they wanted it to do. The other computer could reboot. But there was a chance that both computers would reboot at the same time when doing this maneuver, going from one to the other. And what happened, what was supposed to happen is they were supposed to send a program up to avoid that problem, because if they both rebooted at the same time, the satellite would be lost. I wonder if that's what happened. So I'll have to check the internet and look at what happened to Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's the last one that we sent out there. It's been acting as an excellent repeater for Opportunity and Spirit. But so was Mars Odyssey. That's still in operation. They were using that as a repeater. It's not as good as Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, MRO, we drop it. But it's supposed to be pretty good. Mars Global Surveyor, that thing shut down a couple of years ago. They used that also as a repeater, so that's gone. They also have the European Space Agency Mars Express still in orbit, which also, you know, they did use that as a repeater as well. I can't see why they can't switch over to either Mars Express maybe the Mars Odyssey. You know, they could use that and still send data back. Not as high a rate as the MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. But Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has gone past its lifetime as well. They had the camera on there called High Rise. I think that thing failed. You know, little by little, they're going to have to send another one out there, Dick. I wanted to comment on tomorrow's launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base, WS launch. They're sending a telescope up called the WISE, Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. It's a pretty big thing. It's about 10 feet high. If you stood it in a room, it's about 6 to 8 feet wide. It's a fat-looking thing. Second, I saw it. I thought it looked like the R2-D2 from the Star Wars movie. It's a big. And, when I read the article, they commented that some people think it looks like that. It's pretty fat. It's basically a gigantic thermos bottle. You know, that's really what why it looks like that. They want to keep it very, very cold. You know, close to absolute zero. I think it's, I read 16, 17 degrees Kelvin. It's got a 6-foot mirror in it, and it's going to be looking at, you name it, everything from brown dwarfs to ultra luminous infrared galaxies, which are like trillions of suns. We can't even see it with regular telescopes, but in infrared, they're all over the place. On the outer fringes of the universe. So they want to look at that. They want to look at all the asteroids and comets that are near Earth's orbit objects, things that could crash into the Earth. They want to look at that. They take a survey on what's going around there. They're going to increase the knowledge of those by probably 1,000-fold. They want to look at planetary debris around different stars. This thing will do the trick. It's going to go into a polar orbit, like I said, from California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, on a Delta II rocket. Delta II, pretty reliable, but they did have a problem with this one, and it was supposed to go off, but it was delayed, and now tomorrow is the date. A little after 6 o'clock Pacific time, a little after 9 o'clock here Eastern time, in the morning. So, looking forward to that launch. It's going to be, you know, after they do their survey, they're going to take a survey of the sky. Let me drop it. Survey should take about a year. I think they said 10 months. And 100% survey of the whole sky. Both hemispheres, of course. And once they get all that data, they've got all these other telescopes that will look, you know, precisely at certain different locations, things that are interesting after the survey. They'll use the Hubble. They'll use the Spritzer telescope that's in orbit. They'll use the European Space Agency, Herschel Space Observatory. And there's a couple other ones. SOFIA Airborne Telescope they want to put up. Another upcoming one, of course, is the James Webb Telescope, the eventual replacement of the Hubble Space Telescope. And seasons, we'll really zoom in on the different pieces of information that WISE will find up there. It'll be about 300 miles up, a little over 300 miles up, and should be a good scientific mission. It's not getting much. It's not going to get the news that Hubble would, you know, but scientific community is pretty excited about this infrared telescope thing. Back to you, WS-20.
Very nice. So that's the WISE telescope being launched tomorrow. A 6-foot mirror, good size mirror, infrared. The nice thing about infrared is it's got much more penetration of the dust in space. A good infrared telescope will allow you to look through all the dust between us and the center of our galaxy, which I think is the Sagittarius constellation, is approximately where the direction of our center is. And there's multiple supermassive black holes in the center of our galaxy. As they gather more data, they find out that the size of the galaxy and the size of the supermassive black hole in the center is related. The bigger and bigger galaxy has more and more size of black hole in the center, holding it all together. I think ours has a black hole that's something like 10, I think the number was 10 million solar masses. There are good-sized galaxies that have a black hole in the center that is a few billion solar masses. That's hard to believe. It's just out of sight. You and I know that the biggest thing around, the thing that's really large and heavy, is the sun. Can you imagine something that's 10 billion times more massive than the sun? Since the majority of things in the universe that look like stars, that are really suns, are binary, not unary, we're going around a unary sun, a single sun. There are more binaries than unaries. So when you get these super massive things like neutron stars and black holes that are in binary orbits around each other, and those orbits, by definition, will slowly decay. They're radiating gravity waves. They eventually come together. And when they do, you can literally say all hell breaks loose. When two neutron stars come together, that's the best belief right now that I know of as to what gives you a gamma ray burst. And what is a gamma ray burst? You've got one of them per century per galaxy. And we see one every couple of days if you have the right kind of instrumentation. The amount of energy of a gamma ray burst, let me drop. You know that the sun shining on the Earth gives you an amount of power, an amount of power flux density of 1.3 kilowatts per square meter. 1.3 kilowatts per square meter. That's a lot of energy. If you make the mistake of aiming your binoculars or your telescope at the sun and you put your eye at the eyepiece, you're in a lot of trouble. You're liable to burn a hole in the back of your eye. There's a lot of energy there. 1,300 watts per square meter. And we are 93 million miles away from that source. How much energy is that source putting out? 10 to the 27 watts. One with 27 zeros out of it is the number of watts coming out of the sun day in, day out for the last 5 billion years. The sun's going to do that for a total of 10 billion years. 1 watt output for 1 second is called 1 joule. So the sun is turning out 10 to the 27 joules per second. Because it's going to do it for 10 billion years, the total energy output from the sun over 10 billion years 10 to the 45 joules, one with 45 zeros after it. That number of joules of energy, a lot of energy. In the case of a gamma ray burst, you get that amount of energy, not over a period of 10 billion years, you get that amount of energy in approximately 1 second. If that event occurs within 22 light years of where you live, you're gone. Everything is cooked. Game over. So
no matter where you look in the universe, no matter what you study, you think you've seen the brightest, the strongest, the highest frequency, the lowest frequency, the strongest, the hardest X-rays, the softest infrared rays. No matter what you think you've seen, you look a little further to something bigger, longer, wider, higher, lower, whatever. You ain't seen nothing yet. There's a lot going on out there. So with an infrared telescope like this WISE, you can penetrate the dust, you get a better image of what's going on, and you can calculate what kind of angular resolution you can get out of a 6-foot mirror. 1.22 multiplied by the diameter of the telescope, and you divide that by the wavelength. I got it backwards. Wavelength on top, diameter at the bottom, you divide it, and that gives you the angular resolution in radians. So this thing probably has a resolution of milliradians or microradians. Milliseconds of arc or microseconds of arc. So it's going to give you a nice high resolution picture. And I think it said it's going to be running at 16 kelvins of absolute temperature. You have to cool your detector to very low cryogenic temperatures to get this full sensitivity. And I presume there's a consumable gas on board that boils off, liquid helium or whatever, probably liquid helium, in order to get the detector down to that temperature to get that sensitivity. I wonder if they've advertised the amount of life that they expect out of that source of coolant in order to get those pictures out of it. How long do you think it's going to last at all? WS2M, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
Yeah, 15 months, I believe I read. But the entire sky, well, 1.5 skies, you know, that's the lifetime that they're hoping for. That's 10 months. But they go for 15 months. You know, they'll have probably a bit of an extended mission. And it's hydrogen that they're using. It's not helium. They're actually going to use in almost like a solid form. They're calling it. It's such a low temperature. It's almost a
next
almost solid.
At 8 o'clock, welcome to the
Thurman bottle. Within a Thurman bottle. All the equipment that's keeping the first Thurman bottle cooled is being cooled by another one. So, you know, it's like 100 degrees difference between the two. So it's kind of like a cascade type of system. And, you know, the minus 430 degrees or something is Fahrenheit. It converts to about 16 to 17 degrees Kelvin. And that's way down there. On Earth, they have to have vent valve shut tight. They can't have any air get in there. It would become, you know, just a frozen icicle pop, the way they put it. So it's pure vacuum state. Naturally, when they get into space, they'll open up these valves because space is a vacuum, and it'll be fine up there. And then it will eventually vent off and disappear. So, sensitivity is going to be 1,000 times more sensitive than the COBE satellite, COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer, sent up quite a few years ago, which is the telescope. But I used my QSL card. That's the telescope that took a picture of the galaxy of the Milky Way, and I converted that picture for my QSL card. And it's 1,000 more, you know, sensitive than that one, Dick. So it's really a super scope. Thank you.
These space probes are real fun things to talk about. We amateurs pride ourselves in being able to listen to very weak signals in the noise. A skilled operator listening to a moon-bound signal, his hearing system with the mental processing goes down to a 50 hertz resolution bandwidth. Listening for a weak tone buried into a whole lot of noise, listening to that weak Morse code, sending your call letters and the confirmation and the RRR saying that it's confirmed, and by sending a signal up to the moon and getting it back, 2.5 seconds later. 500,000 mile round trip pass, reflecting off a very low reflectivity surface. The moon is, it may look bright to you because it's against a dark sky and you've got dark adapted eyes at nighttime. In reality, it's a very dark material. It has rather poor reflectivity. I think of all the light that hits the moon, I think something like 3 or 5% of it reflects a lot. The rest gets absorbed or scattered somewhere else. So you get a moonbound signal that does separate the men from the boys. Well, you can picture what happens when you want to talk to Voyager, which I believe is still communicating. It's way out beyond the distance of Pluto. Pluto is 39 astronomical units away, 93 million miles times 39, rough distance. And Voyager is way beyond that. At the speed of light, it takes something like 8 hours for the signal to go one way out to Voyager. You can send up a command, hey Voyager, turn on your transmitter and tell me what temperature you're sensing right now. And 16 hours later, you get an answer at the speed of light. Assume it takes no time for it to respond. I may have the numbers a little bit off. But maybe it's 11 hours instead of 8, but you know what I mean. It's a long, and you can calculate that one. And I can recalculate it.
But, comment.
Okay, we're going to get a comment. But how do they do that? Let me drop. They were smart enough to program Voyager in such a way that they can, from time to time, tell it how fast to send the data. When Voyager's real close, you say, yeah, send me the data at 10 kilobits a second. When it's way out there at that distance, and the signal gets weaker and weaker due to the inverse square law, every time you double the distance between you and that transmitter, the signal will get 6 dB weaker. You get 1/4 the power into your receiver every time you double the distance. Well, you double the distance between when you launch that thing and way beyond the orbit of Pluto. That's our long distance. That is the furthest man-made object ever launched in the history of mankind. The Voyager series. I may have the name wrong, but that, those early satellites. And you start telling it to transmit the data back to you at something like 1 or 2 bits per second. And you're narrowing up the phase lock loop on your receiver on the ground to 1 or 2 hertz of noise equivalent bandwidth in order to suck out that data out of that noise. And it's a very slow data rate. But if you've got enough adaptability in the system, you hear it. And one of the discussions I've had on a couple of occasions with Alex, N2NNU, how do you know a radio signal is going to keep propagating when you go that far? And the nice thing about free space is you can predict to the nearest 0.01 dB exactly how strong the signal is going to be. Once you know the distance, you know the transmit power. And that traveling wave tube that started off at 10 watts on Voyager is now down to something like 3 or 4 watts of output, running on a nuclear power supply. There's nowhere near enough light out there to run solar cells. It's running on its own nuclear power supply. And to my knowledge, it's still talking and telling us what the ionization is like as you go beyond the solar wind and you're leaving our solar system and going into really outer space. And it's still getting data out of that thing. Kind of mind-boggling to think about a signal that weak, that far, the time delay that long, and your ability to see it out of the question. You put any of these spacecraft on the moon, which is in our backyard, use the biggest telescopes we got on the Earth or the Hubble or whatever, and you can't resolve those objects at 250,000 miles to the moon. And you're going to resolve something at 5 billion miles out to Pluto? It may not be 5, maybe 3. I can calculate that. 93 million miles times 39 is just where the distance to Pluto is. A lot of miles. How does a signal go that far without getting tired? The nice thing about radio, as long as you don't have any lossy material in between, it just goes and goes. It's much better than the ever-ready bunny, if you know what I mean. Wesley wanted to ask a question. Wait for the beep. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Actually, I have a comment.
We're ready for your comment.
Okay. In that program that I was talking for NASA, we spoke to the officials. Actually, it was done through Alexander Martins from CTC NASA, who was our mentor, and he was taking care of us. The first question that they asked us is, what is this size per chunk for the communication? and what is the format, and then what is the power, and what is the antenna. We say, well, we just have a technology for ground penetrating. We don't have a technology for sending. And they say, well, for us it's important